Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Brothers and sisters, welcome to today's chapter of the Big Picture Show here live on Radio Islam International. I'm your host for today, Mustafa Darsot. A.B. Dawji has run away from South Africa. He is currently flying the skies to head towards the Middle East for his current tour. And yesterday when I spoke to him at the airport, he sent all of you his salams and said that maybe next week he'll try and phone from there because they want to spend, they're obviously spending Jumma at Al-Aqsa and timed it such that the clients who are accompanying him will spend Eid in Aqsa next week, Saturday, inshallah. But as you know, he is not allowed into Palestine anymore. Well, the Israelis have banned him, so he'll be stuck in Jordan. So we may cross over to him next week, Saturday, inshallah. Hope you're all doing well and keeping well under the circumstances. And it's been a very, very hectic week here for us South Africans, especially my dear listeners that are based in Gauteng and in other parts of the interior of the country where it's biting cold and you have to deal with load shedding. Alhamdulillah, here in the city of Durban, but we say alhamdulillah, we don't have load shedding at the moment, but this is because of a catastrophe which we suffered with the major floods that took place in April and again the smaller one in May, where it's obviously upset the entire electrical grid here and it's putting it at heavy risk. So we basically don't have load shedding in the eThekwini or the Durban surrounding region. Nevertheless, we are in solidarity with you because what is currently happening is totally unacceptable. And no matter what our government says, there's no excuse. Speaking of that, the reason for this current fiasco with ESCOM is usually they'll always come up with the excuse of, you know, generators, power units are down or something is down, not enough generation capacity, short of megawatts. But the current problem is due to the illegal, unprotected strike that is currently taking place, which is led by none other than NUMSA as well as NUM, the National Union of Mine Workers. The problem is that it's becoming a very dangerous and a very ugly strike. And the thing is that we are being held, South Africa is being held to the ransom of these unions who know that it is in everybody's interest, in South Africa's interest, to have power on, but are using this opportunity to get back at the government. Word is that Irvin Jim, who is the head of NUMSA, has got it in for Ramaphosa and his government, whatever the... Well, that's... I mean, a lot of people have got the guns out for Ramaphosa. So at the end of the day, you know, all that speculation can be, but why do it at the detriment of South Africans, especially now in this cold winter? And doctors have sounded alarm bells to say that we are playing Russian roulette with our patients. And this is according to Professor Adam Mohammed at Charlotte Makeke Hospital. He says the continuous power cuts have a devastating effect on South Africa's hospitals. Moreover, it affects patients with specific healthcare needs, right? And says that the impact of the constant power cuts is basically negatively affecting the healthcare system. So while this correspondent, this correspondent Tabo Mduli from Eyewitness News spoke to Professor Adam Mohammed. One listener called in to share the story of a father who was on oxygen but was struggling to replace his smaller oxygen cylinder which he relied on during load shedding. Without having access to his oxygen, he could suffer serious health complications. And this is not a problem exclusive to private citizens. And the hospitals are buckling under pressure due to load shedding, which obviously putting people's lives at risk. Now, this is what's happening. This is really what's happening. Now, today, for example, me personally, I needed to phone Telkom because I needed my Telkom bills. I needed a proof of address for something this morning. And the only thing that I've got is a Telkom bill that's got my residential address on it. So I checked up. My last bill came in, and that too, because I called a call center, came in March, for March. But now it's been over 3 months from the date of that bill, so it's not valid. even if I have to take it. So I phoned 10210, to obviously speak to a consultant to get the bills, like what I did the last time. And there's a voice that called in to say that people are still working on at home because of COVID. Well, that's something that needs to change, especially with Telkom. They must get their act together. But the other thing that they want, the voice they called in said that the the impact is also due to load shedding. In other words, your call may not go through because of load shedding, and the reason for that is because there'll be a break in the line. Maybe you have power on this side, on that side there's no power, and it won't be possible to connect. So obviously you punch in the phone number that's required attention, and you hold on for the consultant. And a minute later, it disconnects. I tried that half a dozen times, and same story. So it's only because of that. That's one inconvenience. The other inconvenience is your everything we today are, we're all dependent electronically on our devices to do, whether we're going to a supermarket to do purchases, to do our internet banking payments, whatever it is, because fewer and fewer people are carrying cash compared to before. But again, it was about 4 weeks ago that the Standard Bank systems were down, and it was on a Saturday, and a lot of people get paid on a Friday or Friday night so that they have the money for the weekend, and people were at a loss because they couldn't, especially Standard Bank account holders, because they, according to, although the companies paid them, but according to their bank accounts, there's no money, ATMs are down, we went to any, whether you went to Macro or to a corner shop, the speed points weren't servicing those particular cards or those cards issued by Standard Bank, and it was a colossal nightmare. And Standard Bank did own up to it and said this is the story, and they working on it, the systems are done. But what caused it? It was the load shedding. Because at the end of the day, those backup generators that they have for the servers, etc., can only last a certain amount of time. They can only carry so much of fuel. They can, whether it's inverters or whatever it is. So what is actually happening is really an injustice to the people of the country. So that means you, for example, say you drive into Joburg, or you're driving from Joburg to Durban, and you stop at a filling station, and you decide to fill up your tank. Okay, you fill up your tank when you're leaving. That should be the responsible thing to do. But halfway, you need to fill up your tank again. You fill up your tank, you pay with your card, but then the speed point is down. Maybe the speed point is not down, but the bank that issues your card, could be Capitec, Nedbank, Absa, FNB, Standard Bank, anyone, is down. Then you're stuck. And you can't go anywhere. And then the filling station is not going to let you go until you pay that money. That's the ridiculous thing that this is that's happening to us with this bloody load shedding. It's a major, major, major inconvenience to everybody. Whether it's the poorest of the poor that's living in a squatter camp, or whether it's the richest of the rich, it's affected everybody. And the government, as usual, will take it in its stride and treat it like it's one of those problems that we have to deal with. If this was, we talk about third world countries that are not democracies or democracies that have been hijacked. If this was Egypt, if this was, say, Pakistan, where you have a military that's part and parcel of the economy when it comes to business, for the wrong reasons, but they are there. They are involved in the economic sector. You think they would have allowed this to happen? They would have stepped in straight away where they would have been, where they would have had nonsense and got taken out those people. I'm not saying by shooting them, but they would have intervened and made sure that problem stops. Here in South Africa, we have such a dysfunctional army that even when the floods took place here in Durban, the deadly floods, the army were not able to assist properly. Go back to 1 year. Go back to July 2021 when we had the riots. The only time where you saw the visibility of the army for some miraculous reason was during lockdown months of April and May 2020. But apart from that, where have they been? This is where the army needs to be called in. They need to be taken to those ESCOM sites where those striking workers are disrupting the chain of work from taking place, where they're stopping those technicians that need to come in and carry out these emergency repairs so that we can get some sense of sensibility, drop it down from stage 6 to stage 4 or even to stage 2 or stage 1, or maybe do it out here altogether. And that's the reality. So the unions have said that they have said that there's 5 issues on the table with ESCOM. Right? Two are okay, but ESCOM needs to come to the party with 3 more. In their words, ESCOM must improve 3 issues for wage talks to move forward. Move forward, not to settle. Right? Okay, ESCOM has already offered the workers a 7% increase. So one has to ask, what are these 3 conditions or these 3 things of the 5? Right? So they said that the unions have confirmed the parties have concluded talks on the 2 areas of the 5 item offer. Right? Okay, so they said that these are the 3 things. Workers have been complaining about ESCOM unilaterally removing benefits such as double overtime payments for working weekends and while on standby. Right? They also want the withdrawal of transport and accommodation benefits, which when being moved to other power stations, to be reversed. So it turns out so that ESCOM has withdrawn transport and accommodation benefits when they move workers to other power stations. So they want that reversed. And then the third hurdle is a once-off cash payment, which ESCOM used as a sweetener, apparently, as a sweetener, deal sweetener in 2018 for paying workers 10,000 rand to cushion them from the effects of inflation. Really? Noom sir, noom, you guys are so bloody ridiculous. What about that poor person that you are affecting? That person that's battling on oxygen? That person that's suffering? Everybody is affected by the inflation. Right now, forget 2018 effects of inflation. Look at the current effects of inflation. What's happening. And yet you guys want to stand behind Putin and support Putin in this war when you should be demanding that this war must stop so that we can see some sense of normality or life returning to some sense of normality. That's how ridiculous the situation is. Then, of course, you know about the Zonde report, which was released over a week ago, the final report. And, of course, Jacob Zuma held the Jacob Zuma Foundation, called for a press briefing last week at 12 o'clock at Sandton Convention Center, if I'm not mistaken, or in Sandton. And Jacob Zuma, according to the press release, was supposed to be present. But it turned out so he was advised not to come for his own safety. So there we had comical Mzwanele Mani, or Jimmy Mani, who is the spokesperson and the master of spin or propaganda. Then you had the advocate who loses every case for him, who has obviously flip-flopped, advocate Dalim Pofu. And then, you have the firebrand daughter of Zuma, one of the twins, Duduzile Zuma, who were there handling this conference. And of course, the whole idea was to start a 5-pronged Stalingrad attack against Zondo and the commission. So this is the 5 areas. According to them, they said that according to them, they have now, obviously, the legal team would, within the next 2 weeks, next week, approach the Judicial Service Commission to institute wide-ranging grievances against Justice Raymond Zondo, while simultaneously asking the courts to adjudicate on the matters. Well, Jimmy Mani said they still call him President Zuma, although he's former President Zuma, but nevertheless, President Zuma, according to Jimmy Mani or Mzwanele Mani, right, says that President Zuma would request both the courts and the JSC to separately give a serious look into the 5 acts of illegality, breaches of the Constitution, and where applicable, the Judicial Code of Conduct. So what are these 5 areas? Number 1, uncovering the exact nature of the historical relationship between Zuma and Zondo. Number 2, the refusal of Zondo to recuse himself as chairman of the commission when he was reasonably requested to do so. Number 3, the political and factional remarks made by Zondo about the outcomes of the 2017 ANC National Conference. Number 4, gratuitous insults and politically poisoned references to Zuma in respect of the proposed changes to the electoral system as outlined in the state capture report. And number 5, abuse of power by Zondo in his irrational and insensitive remarks that the decision to release Zuma on medical parole was questionable. Zuma believes this remark was intended to influence the outcome of a pending court decision. So already, whatever attempts Zuma made on points 1, 2 have already been, he's already lost those matters by taking it to court. But he's going to try again. And that was what they call the Stalingrad tactics. So people ask, what do you mean by Stalingrad attack or by Stalingrad tactic? Well, it's actually something that we have to unpack on another day, because it's quite interesting that this approach has been used. So basically, they say that where this comes about, connection here. Just bear with me for one minute. So they say that the Stalingrad legal defense is a strategy usually used by a defendant to wear down the plaintiff or legal proceedings by appealing every ruling that is unfavorable to the defendant and using whatever other means possible to delay proceedings. Right? So this is what exactly is happening. From the time the first matter of Zuma went to court, you obviously seen this taking it from one court to another, appealing, using a different approach, a different tactic. That's what they call the Stalingrad tactic or the Stalingrad attack in a nutshell. But to unpack more about that, we'll have to discuss it on another day when we have time, inshallah. Then something very interesting came about speaking about Zuma was we spoke about the Palapala game farm of Cyril, which has been robbed of the $4 million as claimed by Zuma man Arthur Fraser, right? Now it turns out so that in June 2020, months after the robbery that took place at the Palapala farm, the alleged mastermind skipped the country with the aid of two dodgy forex traders, a certain Papa Jay and a man named Prince. So according to Ama Bungane's investigation, they're revealing their identities, their roles in the saga, and listen to this, Papa Jay's surprising connection to former President Jacob Zuma. Meanwhile, a leaked recording raises more questions about the investigation into the theft. So this was what came in today's News 24, and apparently there's a picture of Papa Jay, or what they call Mfondo Jele, posing in a picture photo with former President Jacob Zuma. So that's what you're seeing at the moment there. Now let's move on to international news. Of course, currently what's happening in India is of course on everybody's mind, and is a very serious situation. You must have heard that this week that in the city of Udaipur, apparently two so-called Muslim thugs attacked a Hindu tailor, right, for claiming that he supported Nupur Sharma, right, for his stand against the Prophet. And apparently these thugs, while brutally murdering this man, this tailor, recorded the whole thing on camera. So this was apparently on Tuesday the 28th when it came out. And at the time, it wasn't reported across international media. It was still amongst Indian media. My first reaction to that, and I told people that this is a BJP false flag operation carried out by the BJP for the benefit of the BJP. I was asked a question by a respectable Muslim friend of mine, are you sure? So I said, listen, nothing stops the BJP from paying a few Muslim, in inverted commas, thugs or munafiks or right-wing Hindutva characters for masquerading as Muslims to carry out this heinous crime. Right? And if you just have to look at what happens in Israel and Palestine, that this has been proven, where Israelis masquerade as Palestinians, wearing the kifaya, covering their faces, speaking Arabic, inciting youngsters, the youth, to throw stones or to stab Israelis. For what reason? To achieve the desired outcome. And this is exactly what's happened here. So, nevertheless, yesterday, alhamdulillah, I can say I was vindicated with what I said, because Ashok Swain, who is a professor of peace and conflict research, right, and is also a correspondent for the Gulf News newspaper, right, he's a Hindu based in Sweden, and of course he is totally against the hate that's happening in India, and he says that this is absolutely unacceptable. So Ashok Swain said that, and I've got it here, yesterday he tweeted that the Muslim man who had brutally killed a Hindu in Udaipur, India, right, was being accused as an Islamic radical with a Pakistani connection. Still, they are searching for that evidence, but it is for sure that he was actively working for India's ruling Hindu right-wing party, the BJP. Right? So, this is coming, and Ashok Swain has got over 400,000 followers on Twitter. Then there was my friend CJ Wellerman, who I play his clips on the airwaves. As you know, he's no stranger, right? He tweeted on Thursday night to say that a Hindutva goon with alleged ties to RSS dressed up as a Muslim to instigate communal riots. He was caught and handed over to police in the Sayed colony of the city of Jaipur. This is what's happening. When you got these thugs carrying out this, because at the end of the day, we all know and we cannot deny the fact that you will have Muslims amongst us who will give us a bad name to do things selfishly, emotionally charged. We're not denying that this is a reality. But look at the current context. I think it's very irresponsible and very stupid for a peace-loving Muslim right now in India to be violent in any way whatsoever. Whether it was a protest a couple Fridays ago about Nupur Sharma's attack on Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, or whether it was this past Monday's murder, brutal murder by camera of the Hindu tailor in Udaipur. Recently, there was a video clip going around by Dr. Maria Khan, who is a doctor in Islamic studies, who is the granddaughter of the famous Maulana Wahiduddin Khan, who has also done a Quran translation and author of several Islamic books. A great man, very learned man, very pious man. But a man that had some controversy surrounding him, which, for 1 minute, please don't get me wrong, not that I agree with him, but there was a time that he was actually criticized and being referred to as Maulana BJP. That was at the time of the Babri Masjid destruction 30 years ago in 1992. Because he said, let them carry on, let them take over. You know, that was it. So people gave him that title, which is very wrong. People shouldn't have called him that. And they say that Dr. Maria Khan, when she came up with this clip and said that, oh, Muslims, you shouldn't be protesting, it is wrong, mustn't be violent. Yes, we mustn't be violent, but nothing stops us from protesting. And giving the whole thing like it's, you are apologetic, you are being, like a puppet for the government of the day. Like, yes, tell people, listen, if you're protesting, do it peacefully. Do not allow violence to be part of your modus operandi, because it will be backfire against you. It is not right. It is not acceptable. You are defeating the purpose of such protests, etc. Nevertheless, the reaction against her video clip was quite negative, and for good reason too. And then you have this brutal killing on Monday in Udaipur of the tailor by these two guys who videoed the whole thing and put it on social media. And of course, the whole of Udaipur is on tenterhooks at the moment. And then you got this other character that was caught on Thursday night in Jaipur. If you follow me on Twitter under my Twitter handle at mmdarsot at mmdarsot, you'll find that I retweeted some of these things. You can check it there. look into it. You'll see the CJ Wellerman one about the guy that was caught in Jaipur looking like a Muslim. And he was a Hindutva thug. So the Zionists do it all the time in Palestine. And it's a proven fact. So it's a proven fact also what's happening here in India. And right now, according to an international religious freedoms, this is an NGO, person by name of Rashad Hussein, he cited a report from the Early Warning Project at Germany's Holocaust Museum while making an observation. What is it? That India is at high risk for mass killings. Right. So he is from the United States, right? On Thursday, cited a civil society organization findings to state that India was at high risk of mass killings. And this is according to what the Hindustan Times newspaper reported. So Rashad Hussein is an ambassador at large for the International Religious Freedom, made these remarks at a panel discussion on religious freedom in India. He said that the Early Warning Project at Germany's Holocaust Museum had listed India as the second place among countries at risk for mass killings. The project had said that there was a 14.4% chance of a mass killing beginning in India in 2021 or 2022. Pakistan was listed as the country at the highest risk, with a 15.2% chance of a mass killing in the country. So Hussein said that there was a set of factors that threatened the right of religious minorities in India and added that Washington was speaking directly to New Delhi about its concerns. We have had attacks on churches, demolitions of homes. We've had the ban on hijab. We have got rhetoric that is openly being used that is dehumanizing towards people so much to the extent that one minister referred to Muslims as termites, the destruction of mosques, etc. This is according to him. In September 2018, the BJP leader, Amit Shah, who is the chairman, had described Bangladeshi migrants as termites, adding that they would soon be removed from the electoral rolls in India. Shah is currently the country's home minister, and he was the one that was the mastermind or the architect of the abrogation of Kashmiri semi-autonomy articles 370 and 35A. So that's the reality of what's happening in India. There's much more, of course, but we can't cover it all. Right now, although we've seen at the moment, at this moment in time, there is a drop thanks to the Ukraine war. Maybe it's a diversion. Well, whatever, even if it's a diversion or a distraction, and right now the boogeyman is not so much Muslims, it's Putin and Russia. But Islamophobia still rears its ugly head. But since Biden has come into office, Muslims in America feel less tensioned, less uncomfortable, more at ease, etc. And for some reason, under Boris Johnson, although they were expecting to be, heightened Islamophobia, it's a bit okay, but the stumbling block is none other than Priti Patel, who is the Home Minister or the Home Secretary, and her dislike for Muslims is no big secret. And we've spoken about Priti Patel on the airwaves before. So just recently, there was a report, that a Pakistani-British surgeon and the president of the British Hernia Society, Dr. Ali Sheen, claimed he was a victim of racial triaging at Manchester Airport Security, as a recent study revealed that Islamophobia is still on the rise in the country, meaning in the UK. Ali Sheen said he was exposed to racism when security at Manchester Airport told him to queue for a full body scanner while white passengers were ushered in another direction. The surgeon, who was traveling with his two children, added that he soon saw a Muslim family also being singled out from other passengers to be scanned. Sheen apparently told the local Manchester Evening News about his encounter with a security guard at Manchester Airport before flying to Grenoble, France, in April this year. The leading surgeon said he queued for 2 hours before reaching security for his 8 a.m. flight, noting that the security guard pointed towards a queue at the scanner, even though the smaller arch metal detector was on and usable. So whilst recounting the incident, Ali Sheen explained, I said, why? He said, because they have a system What kind of system is this? I asked him. I challenged him. I knew the reason. To me, it was clear. He said, do as you're told. He was really rude to me. And I said, don't talk to me like that. I told him he had to give me a reason. Then I packed my bags and I looked behind me and saw a distinctly Muslim family. And they were all going through the same scanner as me. They were being directed there by the same person. Other white people were passing through the scanner. He continued. That's what happened to this UK Muslim surgeon. And then they found that another report has come about that Islamophobia has actually grown since 2017's London mosque van attack, if you can remember that. So the chairperson of the Finsbury Park Masjid in North London said at a memorial service of the fifth anniversary of a terrorist attack on the mosque, on the masjid in 2017, right, that Islamophobia in the UK has become worse since the attack. According to Mohammed Kosba, expressed frustration that Islamophobia is much worse now than it was 5 years ago since the attack, and that Muslims do not feel safe in the UK. Makram Ali, a 51-year-old husband, father and grandfather, was killed when Darren Osborne drove a van into the masjid, drove the van into worshippers that were standing outside the masjid after Ramadan Taraweeh prayers on June 19, 2017. Right? So Mohammed Kosba noted that at the time of the attack, the then Prime Minister Theresa May pledging sitting in her office that steps and action, pledged while sitting in his office, that means that Theresa May came to his office, that steps and action will be taken to seriously tackle the disease which causes Islamophobia. However, he explained that a definition of Islamophobia, a first step in developing any policy action, has not even been devised, let alone any steps taken. In fact, it is much more worse now than it was 5 years ago with the institutionalization of Islamophobia by this government and some sections of the media. We won't feel safe until Islamophobia is taken seriously by the authorities and the police. The victim's daughter, Ruzina Akhtar, was also among those at the memorial service and said that as a Muslim woman, she wants everyone to voice any Islamophobic behavior as it still exists, so it is tackled the right way. She remembered her father as a compassionate husband, a loving father, and a doting grandfather who was adored by everyone. That's a sad reality. Just moving back to India, something I forgot completely to cover, that speaking of Nupur Sharma and attack on Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, she tried to move the file from various courts to, she wanted it all, because there were charges opened throughout the country, and she wanted them all to be brought to Delhi court. So according to the New Delhi's top court yesterday slammed Nupur Sharma for her remarks on Islam, and this is what they say, thrusting India into a diplomatic row and sparked huge protests, saying the official should apologize for having, according to this court, in inverted commas, for having set the country on fire. So anger, of course, engulfed in the Muslim world because of her remarks, with nearly 20 countries calling in the Indian ambassadors for an explanation. We all know about the rallies that took place and the demonstration, and police killed innocent people, and of course this murder of the Hindu tailor who supported Sharma. So according to this Indian Supreme Court, right, they said she and her loose tongue have set the country on fire. Right? This lady is single-handedly responsible for what is happening in the country. She should apologize to the whole nation. That's something very encouraging to know, that as much as there's a lot of corruption in India and the courts are to a large extent captured, there is still some hope of justice. Although it's a feeble hope, but there is still some hope of justice. Moving on to Syria, well, as you know, there's been a lot of reports happening in Syria. And just this week, what I found very interesting is that I came across three reports from three different directions. Right? So this week, it was announced that the United Nations Human Rights Commission announced that there have been nearly 307,000, if one wants to put it this way, over 306,000 civilians killed in the Syrian war from March 2011 to March 2021 in 10 years, right? So why I say this is very interesting, because I came across the reporting from different angles. And one has to look at how this reporting has been portrayed. And it's very interesting to see that the propaganda that one uses, that we always talk about Western propaganda, Western mainstream media propaganda, Zionist controlled media propaganda. And yes, don't get me wrong, they all exist. They all exist, right? And take for example, India, Indian mainstream media, especially against Muslims. We see what the likes of that firebrand, most nauseating character, Arnab Goswami. And what happens in Indian media when it comes to Muslims. But then we don't realize that propaganda also exists within our own realm, within our own, if I say, outside the Western media, mainstream media realm, it exists there. So when it came to this report that was published, I found that the approach by, I'm looking at three angles. Western media, which obviously will give it a very dramatic effect. But there was an approach from Chinese media, which is very similar to RT News or to Russian media. Okay. But the Chinese one was a bit more balanced if I compare it to the two. And then one coming from Iran media. So looking at the one from Chinese media, from Xinhua, as in X-I-N-H-U-A, Xinhua Net, which is the wholesaler of news in China, like how we have SAPA, or you have Reuters. Reuters is the global wholesaler of news, and then you've got Associated Press, etc., South African Associated Press. So you have the Xinhua.net, right? According to Xinhua, they said that the headline was "Decade of Conflict in Syria Claims Over 306,000 Lives," UN report. So they say that the conflict in Syria claimed the lives of over 306,000 civilians between 1st March 2011 and 31st March 2021, according to the United Nations Human Rights Office. Okay. So that was the headline from Xinhua Net. Then you look at the headline from Turkey's Anadolu agency, which is also another wholesaler of news to the Turkish media, and said that nearly 307,000 civilians killed in Syrian war from 2011 to 2021. On average, every day for the past 10 years, 83 civilians suffered violent deaths due to Syrian war, or 1.5% of the total population. So how it starts off, that the Human Rights Office said its report followed rigorous assessment and statistical analysis of available data on civilian casualties, and estimated that 306,887 civilians were killed in the 10-year period. The conflict-related casualty figures in this report are not simply a set of body abstract numbers, but represent individual human beings. This is according to the United Nations Human High Commission for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, who is the former president of Chile. Then, looking at mainstream media, how they reported it, I'm just trying to find that quickly here. Sorry, just bear with me. They said that... They say that according to, they also put it according to the Human Rights, United Nations Human Rights Report. But I'm not going to go into detail because it's full with dramatic effect, because we know how the West stands on this. Hypocritically, they're very concerned about Syria, but they don't give a damn about Palestine. They don't give a damn about Yemen. Right? Then you come to Iran's Kayhan news media, which is pro-government. Now, listen to their headline. UN Syrian civilian deaths toll over 306,000 since 2011. But the first paragraph, like how I read with the others, or the first two. The first 10 years, listen to this carefully, the first 10 years of the foreign-backed war in Syria, which started in 2011, killed more than 300,000 civilians. The United Nations says Tuesday, the highest official estimate to date of conflict-related civilian deaths in the country. And then they said the conflict began in March 2011 in different parts of Syria and quickly spread to all across the country. It killed hundreds of thousands and destroyed large parts of the country. So, because Iran backs the Assad regime, so this is what it is, that foreign-backed war. But we all know that the Syrian war started inspired by the Arab Spring, which started in late January 2011, with Tunisia, then spread over to Egypt. After the overthrow of Mubarak, spread to places like Libya, to Yemen, Bahrain, and eventually early March to Syria. Iran supported all the uprisings and said, a change is here. However, when it came to Syria, they supported the Assad regime. They said, no, this is foreign interference. For one simple reason, because Assad is their only ally in that region and still continue to stand by him, the butcher. And that's the sad reality. That's why when you look at what's happening currently with the war in Ukraine and the way Russia is doing it with all this, you talk about propaganda coming from Western media. The propaganda that's coming from Russian side is equally disgusting. And that brings me to this article to say that a network of more than 24 conspiracy theorists, frequently backed by a coordinated Russian campaign, sent thousands of disinformation tweets to distort the reality of the Syrian conflict and deter intervention by the international community. Data gathered identified a network of social media accounts, individuals, outlets and organizations who disseminated disinformation about the conflict, with 1.8 million people following the every word. Yes, that's the reality. 1.8 million followers, diehard followers. And it says there that the three principal false narratives promoted by the network of conspiracy theorists involved misrepresenting the white helmets and others as well. Now, anyway, we don't have much time. I will cover it, but I will post it on my Twitter handle as well as on my Facebook page under my name, Mustafa Darsot. However, I see time has run out, so we don't have much time to talk. But this is something very important, that disinformation is on all sides. We see it here in South Africa. When Jacob Zuma was in office, that there was a narrative, of course, there was a lot of exposure about him, but there was that, and there was also a narrative on siding with him. And we've seen it now more since that he's no more in office, with Cyril in office, Cyril Ramaphosa in office, that you have independent online or independent media headed by Iqbal Sovey, which gives a very pro-RET, pro-Zuma narrative, propaganda. Not all of it is incorrect. Because at the same time, whatever is coming from News 24 or other media cannot be even taken seriously, because at the end of the day, we can see the loggerheads that is taking place. If designers have perfected the art of fake news by having these fake accounts, disinformation, tweets, etc., they do it all the time. They've brought with their hasbara, they brought it down to a fine art. The Chinese are doing it in China, whereby they're trying to avoid all news about the Uyghur Muslims. In India, it's on steroids when it comes to Kashmir and Muslims. Just by the sheer numbers of the RSS and the pro-Hindutva following. So, when it comes to more smaller, well, I wouldn't say smaller conflicts, but when you come to a place like Syria, you'll find the same thing there, that you'll have the Assad's tweets. When Sisi took power by overthrowing Morsi, if one has to recall the narratives that were going out there, then making Morsi a villain, that he brought Egypt to its knees, that he was destroying the country, Yet he wasn't given much chance to rule as president. And the positive PR campaign for Sisi, that they were creating pyjamas with Sisi's picture, instead of having teddy bears on it, they had Sisi on it. They made chocolates in the resembling Sisi. What it was, the disinformation, that's what they do, and the same thing that's happening now in Russia. So everybody is guilty of it in a certain way. MBS is doing it in Saudi Arabia. MBZ is doing it in the UAE. The Ayatollahs have done it since the revolution of 1979. Pakistan, currently now, when you got the Chos in charge, what's happening there? So this information is not only from one angle, from the West and the Zionists. It's all out. One has to be practical and pragmatic and has to die and sift out this disinformation, because disinformation leads to problems. That's all we have time for today, dear listeners. Jazakallah to our brother Shoaib, the engineer at the Lens Studio, and see you next week. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.